Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hula Follett, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and I'm tonight's host. My guest this evening is Dr. Abraham Verghese, author of the highly acclaimed My Own Country. Glad to have you with us, Dr. Verghese.
Thanks for having me here.
Perhaps it would be helpful if you would tell the listeners a little bit about how you came to be in Johnson City.
You mean right now here or in general?
No, in general, when you wrote the book.
Well, you know, I came to this country in 1980 as a medical graduate, and I was part of this annual huge influx of foreign graduates who make their way typically to inner city hospitals where there's a crying need for that kind of manpower, because these are not hospitals that people normally, American graduates, choose to go to. But I kind of wanted to, you know, do something slightly different, and I heard about this new medical school, new residency program, and I landed up here for my internship residency, went away to specialize in infectious diseases in Boston, and then I came back as a junior faculty member in 85. And the book really covers the period between 85 and 90, when almost by default I became the AIDS doc of the town.
One thing would be very helpful, again, I think, for the listener, is both to give us a little bit of the flavor of the book and also some sense of your own experience dealing with AIDS patients, would be perhaps for you to talk about a couple of the specific patients. I mean, there are a number of very memorable characters in your book. Certainly, I can think of a number. Perhaps you might talk about a couple of the people that whose experience you thought was especially moving.
Well, I think it might be significant to sort of set the time period, because, you know, looking back, this book is almost about a nostalgic period in the history of AIDS. And my coming here in 1985 as an infectious disease specialist was a curious time. I had just finished training in Boston during this period of time when we were taking care of these young men with bizarre infections with no idea what caused it. And the medical community had come up with this cumbersome definition, AIDS, or acquired immune deficiency syndrome, only so that we could talk to each other. And I had also lived through that, you know, really wonderful moment when the virus was discovered. Just a triumphant moment in science, but the triumph didn't last very long. Within a few weeks, when the antibody test for the virus was established, it became clear that not only were the young men in the hospital that we were seeing carrying this virus, but so were thousands and thousands and thousands of others. And, you know, there was a deep sense of despair at that moment. It was with that kind of backdrop that I came to East Tennessee. And all the pundits had said that a small town of our size, 50,000, at that moment in time, really couldn't expect to see much HIV infection. We were predicted to see one or two cases every year or every other year. And so it was a curious time to come to Johnson City, a time when this disease was viewed as exclusively an urban phenomenon. And my first couple of cases, in retrospect, typified the paradigm that I was about to stumble on. And there's one patient in particular who I recall who really exemplified the paradigm. I call him Hobart in the book. And he grew up in this town, in a surrounding town, really. And he left the small town for all the same reasons you and I leave small towns, jobs, education, opportunities. But in his case, he was also leaving because he had felt he was an alien in this town. One of his earliest recollections is at the age of 8, having his brother turn to him and say, "Must you walk that way?" as they're walking through a schoolyard. And he was only 8 years old, and that became a very important metaphor for him, because it became one of many, many differences that the town pointed out to him, not just the way he walked, but the way he talked, the way he dressed, and ultimately his sexuality. And so, to no one's surprise, I suppose, he left at the age of 18 for San Francisco. He went there and he had a wonderful job in a hotel and wore a tuxedo every day. He was very proud of that, showed me pictures of it. And then one day he woke up with chest pain and went to San Francisco General, was found to have shingles, and one complication led to another. And while he was there, he not only found out he was HIV positive, but found out that he was pretty far advanced. To make a long story short, he stayed there 5 weeks, and when he came out, his apartment was gone, his job was gone, all his belongings were in the basement of a friend's apartment, a friend who was also sick and in the hospital. I mean, it was difficult for us here in Johnson City to imagine the utter devastation taking place in closed communities like the Castro in San Francisco or the Village in New York. And so he made the one call that he must have hated to make, which was to call his parents and say, I'm coming home and I have AIDS. And there I was at the tail end of this complex migration at a time when there really was no endemic HIV infection in our town, or not very much. But we were seeing this fairly impressive influx of young men returning home, typically young men returning home with the virus. So I think Hobart's case is very, very memorable in my mind, and I remember particularly before he died, he had this prolonged fever, and I had him in the hospital and couldn't get to the bottom of what was causing the fever. And he called me up a few days before he died, and he said, Abraham, when I die, I don't want an autopsy, but if you want to, you can come to my house and take biopsies of some of my organs so that you'll know after I die what happened. And I guess he knew that I'd done this from time to time with other patients too. And I remember going to his house and being struck by his appearance in the bedroom. He lay in his bedroom, and it was not just the sight of his body which was striking, because he was lean and emaciated, and this fever had burnt him down to a stringy remnant. And he was lying there almost Christ-like with this white diaper and flowing hair. But more than that, I was struck by what was on the walls. This was his childhood home, his childhood bedroom. And yet the icons on the walls weren't really his. They were icons of his parents, pithy needlepoint verses framed in cedar, and a picture of Christ at Gethsemane. And seeing that, it just really affected me greatly. It brought home to me this heroic journey that he'd made, away from home to the city and then tragically back. And I'm recounting this case, Hugh, because that night when I got home, I drew up the first draft of a scientific paper that's become something of a landmark paper in rural AIDS, describing this complex migration and why small towns like ours were seeing a totally unexpected number of cases. And even as I wrote that, though, I had the strong sense that the cold, unimaginative language of science, and really science is quite unimaginative in its language, didn't begin to do justice to the heroism of these young men, or my sense of the heartache of the families, or my own transformation living through the story many, many times. He was one of many memorable cases, but I chose to talk about him because he really exemplifies the mystery of why this town had so many HIV-infected persons.
Certainly the case you've mentioned is one in which the individual is homosexual. And I want to come back maybe and talk a little bit later about those who aren't. But certainly one of the things that comes through in your book is the reaction of the community and the people to individuals who are gay. The fact that this particular person had to leave home, or at least felt as if he had to leave home in order to be who he was. Why is it, do you think, that people are so afraid of homosexuals?
Well, the book is also very much the story of my own education about gay men and homosexuality. I think I began this experience, I won't say I was homophobic, but I was certainly homo-ignorant. I really hadn't been around gay men enough to understand and understand anything about them. And the book is very much about how I came out the other end transformed, not just in the sense of having empathy, because that word doesn't quite capture it, but with an acute sense that an acute sense of regret that it took a disease like this for me to be open to what gay men have to teach us. I actually feel that, heterosexual men have a lot to learn from gay men about being men. I don't mean sexually, but I mean otherwise. I think so much of what passes for maleness in our communities, particularly among adolescents, and in El Paso, where I am now, particularly among gang members, so much of this machismo isn't really maleness at all. It's a posturing that males engage in because they think this is what women want to see. And to be around gay men is to see the spectrum of male experience, if you will, the spectrum of the emotional range that a man can explore, should he choose to. And that's been very enlightening. I think the most gratifying thing about the book is that heterosexuals have read it and come through the difficult parts and come out the other end similarly transformed, and have written to me saying, you've really changed my view on this. And similarly, gay men have picked up the book as being an explanation for their lifestyle that they think their parents will find palatable. And I was very honored 3 weeks ago at the American Book Association convention to receive the Lambda Literary Award for nonfiction, which is the gay lesbian award. And I'm the first non-gay person to receive it, I believe. But to come back to your question, I don't know where the horror or the emotions that are generated by homosexuality, I don't know where they originate, but very clearly they are the reason why this disease has such a metaphor with it. When I was in this town, I had the distinct sense that I was dealing with two diseases. There was the virus on the one hand, but almost eclipsing the virus was this huge metaphor of shame and anxiety, shame and guilt. And, the origin of that metaphor lies squarely in our inability as a society to come to terms with the existence of gay and lesbian people.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things you're talking about, shame, one of the stories that you recount is the first time that you go to the Connection, which is the homosexual, or used to be the homosexual bar in town, and speaking of being afraid of being seen, right, going into the Connection. It's not just a fear of gays, perhaps even worse, a fear that you might be perceived as being gay.
Exactly. And I think we're conditioned into that from school and college. I can remember that my only knowledge of homosexuality prior to this experience consisted of the jokes that were in poor taste that pass for a heterosexual response to this condition.
The stereotypical
stuff. And, I think as a society we've all come a long way. It's become fashionable for all sorts of people to go to gay bars to dance, and the music is reputed to be the best. And, a lot of the stigma has sort of diminished, and I think the disease has had a lot to do with that. But even so, in a small town, and I'm sure still in this town, the metaphor remains huge. I lost one patient to the metaphor. He took his life at a time when the virus was doing nothing, simply because he couldn't, put up with what it meant to have this disease in the town.
Okay, part of what happened then is that it having the disease signified that you were gay, even if you weren't. And so people who had contracted the disease in some other way were equally afraid of being found out, lest other people think that they were homosexual. I specifically remember the case of the Johnsons,
right.
People identified as the Johnsons from Kentucky,
right,
who went to great pains. Their doctor hid their medical files, which showed that they were HIV. They refused to tell their children for a long time about the disease. In fact, at one point in the book, you said that the husband would have been a great spokesperson.
I think
for AIDS, but was afraid,
right,
to do so.
Yeah, I think it astonished me, but I guess it shouldn't have surprised me. He was such an upright, outstanding individual. Had he spoken out openly about this disease, I had the feeling that he underestimated the impact he could have had on the way society began to perceive this, at least in his community. But the metaphor was so huge that it tainted everyone around, regardless of your sexuality. It even tainted healthcare workers. I began to feel in the town as though I had lost my own identity. I had become the AIDS doctor, and that was the metaphor that I now carried. An extraordinary event in human history, because very few diseases, but for the plague and to a lesser degree syphilis, have had this kind of association with it.
Let's pause briefly for a moment to welcome any new listeners who've just tuned in. I'm Hugh LaFollette, and my guest on Ideas and Issues this evening is Abraham Verghese. And tonight we're discussing his book, My Own Country, and his work with AIDS and HIV patients in Johnson City. Your book chronicles, I think, some acts of heroism and great caring, but you also talk here and there of examples of ignorance, closed-mindedness, perhaps even mean-spiritedness. Is that sort of part of the nature of human beings, that we can be closed-minded, or was there something peculiar about this disease that led people to be perhaps less caring than they could have been? Because we're talking about doctors and nurses, but just people in general in the community.
Well, I think that this disease was kind of a litmus test for all of us in the healthcare profession. I think we had sort of fallen into the sense that medicine was all about cure. We were caught up in this conceit of cure. And I think we also had the sense that there was no personal risk, whatever else there was. You know, you were not liable to die from taking care of your patients. And this disease was kind of a rude reminder that 100 years ago, it was commonplace for physicians to die from smallpox and other things that they contracted from their patients. And this disease served as sort of a cruel reminder of what the profession used to be before the days of, you know, very high incomes and conspicuous consumptions and all the things that the public has picked on as being sort of the worst elements of who we are. And I think that I feel that my book, in effect, had much fewer episodes of bad reactions than someone would have predicted for this town or the South. One of the advantages of being an outsider is that you don't hear necessarily all the stereotypes. You don't come with a preconceived notion of what the South is. And I found that what little prejudice I saw, I experienced much more of it elsewhere, not in the South, but on the East Coast, really. I think that the book is much more a testament of outstanding reactions from simple people who, you know, didn't have the, you know, the worldly experience to react to this in a sophisticated cognitive way, but it struck me that whatever views they held in the abstract about religion, about homosexuality, were clearly wiped out by their relationship to their kin. Kinship was so much more important than any biases you had. And I think overall the book is a testament to the fiber of the people of East Tennessee and how they came through. There were ugly episodes, and it's uncommon now to hear physicians express this kind of statements about HIV, but at that time it wasn't, and we saw some unfortunate responses. I am so excited that the generation of medical students graduating now, you know, I was recently invited to be the Johns Hopkins commencement speaker, and I was really honored by that, and clearly they invited me because of a sentiment in the book that appealed to them. And as I was speaking to them, it struck me that here was a generation that had heard about HIV from high school, pre-med, med school, and unlike the rest of us who felt almost as though we were making a choice which way to go, they have clearly inherited this disease as part of what they will face, along with diabetes and hypertension. And I almost sometimes think that our generation of doctors is a lost generation. We have forgotten about, you know, the business of healing. It's been all the conceit of cure, and we've paid the price for that. The public is deeply disenchanted with medicine, at least in my travels, that's what I hear. And I think this new generation is coming into it for all the right reasons, or more importantly, they don't develop the cynicism that I think characterized much of our generation. So I hope that answers your question here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talk about the cynicism, but one of the things that I saw in your book was the transformation, not just of your attitudes toward homosexuals, but in a sense your attitudes toward medicine itself. You said that you partly chose infectious diseases because it was the one area in which you could find cures. And it's an area in which you could feel proud about what you were doing because you were going to help patients. Toward the end of the book, you talk about how frustrating it is to work with patients when you know that you certainly are not going to cure them. Mm-hmm. And you had this interesting phrase where you spoke of the examination as the dance of the Western shaman. Could you talk a bit more about how your views of medicine might have changed through this experience?
Well, and I'd also like to emphasize that this transformation I'm about to describe is not just mine. I think when I talk to my age group physicians who came through training about the same time, we've all basically gone through this transformation. We went into this business, I went into this business, because this was the one specialty that was all about cure. And I remember hearing that from my mentor here in Tennessee, Steve Burke, who said that, you know, this is the one specialty where we can effect cure, unlike cardiology and other specialties where often you're just sort of playing around with a disease that is intrinsically irreversible and continues to progress. And it was a rude shock to awake to the realization that I was spending my time taking care of an incurable disease. The mantle of the oncologist had descended on me when I hadn't chosen it. And yet in that discovery came, in that moment came a discovery, a realization that's been profound for me and I think for others. Because we couldn't cure, out of frustration, out of lack of anything else to do, I began to engage with my patients in a way that I never had before. You know, visiting with them much more, spending more time with them, and ultimately going to their houses and getting to know who they were, and paradoxically finding out that in the process of having nothing to offer, I had everything to offer. namely myself, and that my presence was in itself a therapy of sort, a healing of sort. Now, this is an important distinction between curing and healing. I think that every illness has a physical element which you can cure, and almost a spiritual violation which traditionally Western medicine has sort of ignored in the last 40, 50 years. To give you a crude example, if you've ever had your apartment broken into and your TV and your stereo removed, and then an hour later the police come back and give you back the stereo and TV, they've gotten it, well, you've been cured, but you've not been healed. You still feel that sense of violation. Well, every disease has those two facets. But, you know, 100 years ago, when there were not many cures, the old horse and buggy doctor dispensed healing. He was not able to do much about the physical element, but he or she was sure able to do a lot for that spiritual violation by their mere presence, by their, you know, this profession was called the Ministry of Healing many years ago. It's not the term we associated with modern medicine anymore. And I think this disease forced us to recognize that distinction and made me appreciate that even though I could not bring about a cure, I could bring about a healing, by which I mean not some New Age mumbo-jumbo, but simply a coming to terms of family, patient, and doctor, and illness, in a sort of reconciliation of all these factors, and you know, a resignation to the inexorable progression of all our lives, you know, of which death is the culmination. This was a you know, a profound insight for me, and has really changed my life. And I think it's done the same for many infectious disease physicians who I talk to. They've pretty much become somewhat skeptical of the traditional medical industrial complex and more willing to step away from the, you know, traditional medical school model and practice a folksy kind of medicine that the old-time family docs in this area, you know, the doctors of Dr. Carol Long's generation, knew all too well and practiced very well.
So you do think that this is a change in the current climate of the American physician?
I think it's a change in the right direction. I mean, Okay. Clearly the reason the public is looking for therapies of holistic medicine and naturopathy and homeopathy and all that sort of stuff is the one element that Western medicine doesn't provide is this taking care of the violation of the spirit that accompanies illness. There's a beautiful book that I recently reviewed for the New York Times Book Review called Spontaneous Healing by Dr. Andrew Weil. And he points out that oftentimes, because we're locked into our knowledge of prognosis and the natural history of disease, we engage in a form of medical hexing. People come to us with their cancers or their infection, and we stage them and tell them what's in store for them, almost as though we don't acknowledge the possibility that their course might be markedly different. And I think all this has been good for medicine. The flip side of this awful, awful disease are the wonderful transformations it brought about in families, and doctors and in patients. I can't tell you how many families said to me, after having come to terms with their sons having AIDS and being gay, you know, towards the time of death, how many of them said to me, you know, in an extraordinary way, this disease has brought us closer to our son than we would ever have become. It's quite conceivable that he would have lived another 40 years and we would have died and we would never have connected with our son this way. And young men told me the same thing. They would say, Abraham, I would never wish this disease on my worst enemy. And yet, in a funny sort of way, it's the best thing that happened to me, because I might have lived another 50 years in the big city and come back from my father's funeral and never have understood that of all the things I would give value in my life, things like fame, fortune, good looks, reputation, that none of these really held up. And the one thing that would ultimately give me meaning were the successful relationships I'd negotiated over a lifetime, particularly with parents, with siblings, with children. And I think that flip side of this awful, awful disease is perhaps the reason that this book is being picked up, and, you know, that I have such an extraordinary response to it. I don't mean sales, Hugh. I mean the outpouring of emotion and letters that tell me that it struck a chord. There's an element here that has to do with all our lives. This is not about someone else or some other entity that doesn't touch us. It's really about us.
Certainly one of the things that happens when physicians start to care in the way you're talking about, and again, it comes out in your own story, in my own country, is that it's very draining, and that there are personal costs of doing it. You got the sense after you'd been here for 4 years, that you'd been the primary physician for 80 AIDS patients, that you just had to have a break, you had to get out of here. Was it worth it?
Well, you know, I think that I should also qualify my last answer and make the point that I don't want to at all suggest that, you know, other doctors aren't caring and all that. I think all of us are discovering this thing about ourselves, and even if we want to spend more time with patients, the traditional model has forced us into these little cubby holes and time slots, and, you know, we're not able to do as much as we want to. I wanted to qualify that because as I hear myself, I feel as though I'm putting down other physicians, and I'm certainly not doing that. Yes, this disease did, and this experience did have its costs, but, you know, in an extraordinary way, I can't imagine being in any other area. I have this self-fulfilling prophecy that most of us in HIV care need to take breaks from time to time and need also changes of geography, perhaps, even though that's a major upheaval in a person's life. I've known many HIV physicians who've taken breaks, who have moved around, but the funny thing is that I don't know anyone who's keen to leave the business. People don't appreciate that this experience is as rewarding as anything else, and it's actually, I get the sense that I get more out of it than I give. I have nurses who've worked for me who go elsewhere for, you know, they move or they go to another city, another doctor's office, and they call me up and say, "Abraham, it's so boring here." And when they say that, it strikes me that you couldn't write a job description that encompasses the nurses, the social workers, the caseworkers who work in HIV, because at some point it becomes your calling and it becomes an extraordinary discovery that you're doing more for them, and then you're doing, and then in the process you're doing so much for yourself.
Just as to wrap up here, I noticed in I guess it was one of the reviews of your books that there was a reference to a new novel on which you're working. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. I just have a 2-book contract with HarperCollins. One is a collection of short stories, which are really all AIDS-related short stories. AIDS being such a window into the human condition. Every short story I've published in The New Yorker and elsewhere has had that theme. The second is about doctors and drug use and suicide. I lost my closest friend, who was my medical student, my intern, and my resident, and then took his life because of a relapse into cocaine addiction. He was a gifted tennis player, had played on the pro tour. And when he died, the moment people found out that it was somehow drug-related, it was as though he had never lived. And, you know, they didn't even miss a beat. And I was sort of struck by that. There was a certain void that we crossed over without acknowledging. And so I'm exploring that aspect of things using the metaphor of our friendship to look into doctors and their friendships and their personal lives.
Sounds fascinating. I look forward to reading it. I've been talking this evening with Abraham Verghese, author of My Own Country. I'm glad you're able to join us. I hope you've enjoyed the program. This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.